It's interesting that this recognition that systemic change has to come from governments has come at a time after huge disinvestment in public sector capabilities and capacity over many years, including in environmental agencies.
Hello, and welcome to Economics for Rebels, the podcast of the European Society for Ecological Economics. Up until recently, it was an act of rebellion to pursue economics as if nature mattered and the earth was finite. This rebellion must bring a major shift to economic thinking. Our podcast is dedicated to exploring the economics of just and sustainable transformations in conversations with scientists, experts, activists, pushing for rapid and radical change for people and planet.
Welcome to our podcast. I'm today's host, Sufut Swamgassan, and you're listening to the Economics for Rebels podcast. There's a long history of states solving major societal challenges through ambitious and mission-driven public policy, such as getting a person on the moon or the foundation of the UK's National Health Service. But the last few decades have seen declines in the ambition and entrepreneurship of the state at a time when global sustainability challenges have called for more and better leadership. How did this happen? Why is this a problem for implementing policies consistent with the goals of ecological economics? And what can we do about it? It's an immense pleasure to welcome Rosie Collington onto the show. Rosie is the author, alongside Professor Mariana Mazzucato, of The Big Con: How the Consulting Industry Weakens Our Businesses, Infantilizes Our Governments, and Warps Our Economies. Rosie is a political economist at the Institute for Innovation and Public Purpose at UCL, studying how governments can develop the ability to govern socioeconomic transformations. Welcome, Rosie.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Rosie, I want to take this conversation in a couple of directions. So there's tens of resources online and, of course, in your book, where people can learn about the role of the consulting industry in disempowering the public sector from being able to solve society's grand challenges. So I'd like to cover the things you normally chat about quite briefly, but then I want to move into talking about the juicy lessons from your subsequent work about how to measure and build public sector capacity to actually solve big problems. But for starters, so do you mind introducing our listeners very briefly to a history of the rise of the global consulting industry and its expanding role within the public sector, starting from the early 20th century?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, thank you so much for having me. It was a huge pleasure to receive your invitation to join. So we started looking at the role of the consulting industry in governments during the pandemic, well, prior to the pandemic, but we would started doing research looking at the scale and scope of outsourcing to consultancies during 2019 and 2020. Now, what we became very interested in quite early on was how this sector had developed and evolved and grown concomitantly, of course, with the kind of broader transformations in capitalism. And I think there are some perhaps areas of society and the economy and politics that we might be able to look at in abstraction from these broader, you know, macro economic transformations, but the consulting industry isn't one of them. So there are some brilliant historians who have traced the emergence of the consulting industry back to the end of the 19th century, where groups of engineers were being contracted independently by manufacturing companies who were trying to manage their innovation processes and required some kind of short-term, or felt that contracting engineers on a short-term basis would be a good way to do this. And then these engineers kind of formed into companies, and that was the birth of the consulting industry as we know it today. Now, of course, it was very small at that time. It slowly spread again through a number of kind of key developments in both corporate governance, so with the spread of Taylorism, for example, across firms in North America and Europe, and then within states during the Second World War, when governments increasingly were looking for these kind of logistics and technical skills that previously were existing within these kind of new emerging consulting companies. And then as the welfare states of Europe grew and as companies became multinational firms with more complex models of corporate governance during the decades after the Second World War, we saw really it was during this time that the consulting companies that we know today, or that are many of which are household names, really became very big. Of course, then, as many people will be familiar with, and or if they're not, perhaps wouldn't be surprised to learn, it was during the 1980s that we really saw the growth of consulting companies in many governments that were adopting neoliberal kind of policy reform agendas, including in the UK. So one statistic that we include in the book is that at the beginning of Margaret Thatcher's tenure in 1979, the UK government was spending £6 million a year on management consultants. And by the end of Thatcher's tenure, 11 years later, it was £246 million a year. So really, you know, what the kind of line that we use in the book is the history of consulting is the history of capitalism.
Thanks, Rosie. So there's a lot of driving forces behind this history, which are detailed in your book. But do you mind discussing the role of ideology in the rise of consultancies, and specifically, you know, the influence of neoclassical economics informed new public management theory?
Yeah, so this is super interesting, right? Because what happened from around the 1980s, or emerging in the decades prior to that, but from the 1980s, the idea that governments should get out of the way, that the public sector wasn't really able to create value for economies and for societies, started to become dominant. Now, many people will know that this was not a kind of natural or any way neutral process, but was one that was actively promoted by I guess firms that were set to benefit from this, and ideologues and economists who were set to benefit also often from this process, or, you know, many of them also did kind of fundamentally believe in the value or the intrinsic value of an economic system of free markets, or markets able to function under kind of perfect conditions. But one thing that we became very interested in the book was, again, kind of following on from the history that we were just discussing, was how some of these ideas around the role of government then transformed with the rise of New Labour and in the UK, and forms of third way ideologies and politics in many countries around the world from the 1990s and 2000s. And this might be quite surprising, or quite a surprising argument that we make. But what we show was that, you know, often when we're talking about the third way and Tony Blair and New Labour in the UK, we sort of lump Tony Blair together with Thatcher, and we lump these kind of periods and these different ideologies together as though Blairism was a continuation of Thatcherism. And actually, the differences are quite important for understanding why the consulting industry continued to grow and, in fact, became even more entrenched during the years of the third way at New Labour. And we look at, in particular, this idea that was captured in the book Reinventing Government, published in 1994 by two management consultants who were also working as, I think, political science or economics professors. And they argued that the role of government was that it should steer but not row. So this was quite different to Thatcherite neoliberalism, which argued that, you know, the most effective societies or economies are ones that governments get out of the way as much as possible. You know, in fact, the steer but not row ideology or mantra was saying there is an important role for government is to set the direction for the economy and kind of shape economies, but it shouldn't be doing things itself. And in fact, it's still more effective and more efficient to be using the private sector as much as possible. And it was then during the following period in the UK and in many other countries that we saw the kind of spread and entrenchment of management consultancies in government. So these were actually two quite different ideologies, but they both had kind of similar effects for the entrenching of management consulting in government, albeit for different reasons.
Okay, so your book details many case studies of the ways consultancies undermine the functioning of our governments. And there have been a couple of anecdotes that made it really far in the press, right? You had one on the role of Deloitte in UK's COVID test and trace system. So at one point, the UK government was paying consultants £1 million a day for services that were subsequently assessed as a complete failure. And you have this legendary quote, "It just seemed like every project had loads of wandering Deloitte people. The sheer volume of them that were around created the situation of these zombie emails just arriving all the time, taking our attention away from actual work." The other story that made it really far in the press was you exposing some fundamental conflicts of interest in McKinsey's advice for Puerto Rico's debt restructuring in the mid-2010s, where their investment arm stood to benefit from their advice. Now, which stories from your book do you love that you wish got more attention?
So probably the cases that we include in the book on climate consulting. So we had anticipated that this chapter would maybe get the most attention and would be of most interest to many people. And it probably hasn't received as much attention as the kind of core, I guess, the kind of core arguments in the book. But it's really interesting for many reasons. You know, one is that it really epitomizes how, as we say in the book, these big multinational consultancies have ridden the wave of kind of corporate governance trends and transformations. So there has been in the past couple years in particular, and I mean this very recently, a kind of explosion in investments within the companies, within the big three and the big four, which are the companies that we focus on, and other large multinational IT consultancies. There's been a huge surge and increase in investment in their climate and sustainability consulting services. This is, of course, coupled with surging demand from the private sector for advice on how to implement ESG strategies. And the big three and the big four, by the way, have been some of the biggest kind of developers and suppliers of the various ESG, or the hundreds of ESG frameworks that are in place around the world. So this kind of development, this boom in consulting services, epitomizes the broader historical trend that we discussed, which is that when new kind of trends have emerged within business, within capitalism, within governments, consultancies have kind of ridden their wave, and they've also helped to entrench them by promoting different services. Now, the question that we ask in the book is why now? Why is it that, you know, consulting services in this area are booming at this period in time? And the conclusion that we come to is basically that this is because we are now at long last in an era where it seems like systemic intervention by governments will be inevitable, and in many countries is already taking place. And what we can see in kind of previous iterations of consulting trends is that often they have come at a time of, you know, that there being the potential for increased government intervention, and others have argued that they have served as a way to kind of resist government intervention or resist increased government intervention by suggesting or creating the impression that, you know, the private sector that or carbon intensive sectors that do not want to see increased regulation are kind of using this as a way to say, hey, look, we are actually doing something effective here by ourselves. We don't need governments to get in the way and do this for us. So it's pretty interesting. We have a few cases in the book. One of the cases in this chapter is also super interesting because it shows the dynamics of what happens within the firms. So we know that many people are attracted to go to work for these companies in the first place, precisely because they're promised, you know, you will be able to be at the forefront of the green transition. You'll be able to have a social impact. You'll be able to, you know, do something for good. And many people are becoming disillusioned with this after working in these firms for a few years. And this is something that two journalists at the New York Times uncovered during an investigation, which was that 1,000 consultants from McKinsey had actually written to partners of the firm, calling on them to start publishing information and details of the carbon emissions of the biggest clients of McKinsey. That when the partners refused to do this, there was kind of uproar within the firm, and some of those people that had been involved in this collective letter or this joint open letter actually resigned in response to McKinsey's response to this. So I think it tells you a little bit again about the dynamics and why people go into this sector in the first place, which is not, again, necessarily, and I would say rarely, to be honest, because of the money, or just because of the money. Is actually often because there are promises that this is, you know, an important value creating sector.
Yeah, that is so interesting. It reflects a lot of the observations I've had in the powerful role of these high salaried jobs that are nominally able to appease your conscience at attracting people out of the environmental sector and into the financial sector.
Exactly.
But in that way, you know, disempowering, you know, potentially some of the most important political opposition. That's something that I've seen and I'm kind of interested in myself.
Yeah, it's super interesting. I think it's super fascinating, and maybe doesn't get enough attention because there can sometimes be a bit of a tendency, I think, you know, among people who are lucky enough to get the few jobs in progressive think tanks and government and whatever, you know, in interesting government jobs in academia, that people who don't do those jobs, you know, maybe don't care about having an impact or whatever. But it kind of overlooks the fact that actually they are also promised by these companies, you know, that they will be able to, you know, do good. What's the ESG, doing well by doing good, or whatever the ESG tagline is.
So I wanted to follow up on something that you said in your last answer. So you came this idea that's been discussed in the literature of, you know, consultancies as a smokescreen, you know, demonstrating that the private sector is addressing some of its major regulatory risk, and therefore as a smokescreen to avoid further government regulation. But there's another school of thought that we have, you know, individual businesses going ahead and taking important progressive actions, then develop sort of the evidence base and the ability of government to draw on case studies when it tries to propose new regulation. So obviously those two stories are kind of in tension. So where do you fall in the kind of the dichotomy there?
Oh, I think both. You know, I don't look at the private sector or businesses as being homogenous in any way. You know, I, as a political economist, I'm interested in interests. You know, I'm interested in how firms' interests shape their actions and you know why they're working in particular ways, you know, for or against a green transition or green transitions, energy transitions. But there's, you know, we can't say that the private sector is acting unilaterally and homogeneously all the time. It's actually very, very, very different. There's been, I'm reading at the moment actually a book that I read a couple years ago by Catherine Hochstetler. That's called The Political Economy of Energy Transitions, and that's very related to my PhD work. And, you know, she talks about how we should understand these interests in terms of coalitions. So, you know, of course, in energy transitions, for example, there are going to be some immediate winners and some immediate losers. And we should anticipate that, you know, renewable energy companies, regardless of where they're based in the world, have an interest in, you know, government, or often have an interest in government energy transitions, because they are the companies that are going to benefit from contracts for developing infrastructure, etc. Whereas, of course, carbon intensive or fossil fuel producing companies, let's say, and other companies that might struggle to use renewable sources of energy are unlikely to be supportive of government action in this way. So, no, I think I actually agree with both points, if I've understood it correctly.
So consultancies are now playing a larger and larger role in the ongoing function of the state. So why is this a barrier for solving grand challenges like decarbonisation or reversing biodiversity loss?
So it's a few different reasons. And it's important, I guess, to say at the outset as well that we are very clear in the book that consultancies are used in both government and business for different reasons. So there's this acronym that colleagues at University of Bristol came up with, which is FEEL, which is that, so that describes that consultancies are used as or contracted as facilitators, experts, extras, and legitimators. We are particularly interested in the book. We do discuss conflicts of interest and how this can undermine the types of advice that consultancies are likely to give to governments as well as business. But we are particularly interested in the book in how a reliance on consultancies to deliver core functions of government, and by which we mean not just public services, or the management of public services, but also, you know, policymaking processes, forms of evaluation, technical expertise in environmental ministries. These things that we often don't think about as being very specialist, but of course are very specialist in government. When there is a reliance on consultancies and other third parties to deliver these services, then governments are not developing those services internally. The type of learning that is necessary for the kind of evolution or a kind of endogenous development of capacity or capabilities for delivering something like a green transition, isn't happening when something is outsourced. So it's not just a kind of risk in the short term, because this can be more expensive, for example. It can be more expensive than investing internally to deliver something, or because of the conflicts of interest, but it's also because the less government is doing something, the less it is able to directly, the less it is able to develop the ability and adapt this ability in the evolving context within which it is embedded. And so to make that argument, we draw on innovation economics, or the economics of innovation and evolutionary economics theories and approaches to learning and capabilities development, which of course is Mariana's background as well.
Yeah, perfect. So now I want to move on to your work post-book. So let's take stock. So where are we now? After decades of what you would call the infantilization of the state, we now need to turn the tide and rebuild states' capacity to solve big societal challenges. So what's the current status of state capacity to deliver ambitious policy? And what first steps can we take to start rebuilding those capabilities?
Yeah, I mean, it's super interesting. Well, of course, I think this is super interesting because it's what I'm doing my PhD research on. So I'm focusing specifically on green transitions, and by which I mean, you know, these centrally coordinated strategies in the wake of the Paris Agreement to achieve carbon neutrality, net zero, or other, you know, large scale emissions reductions. So, you know, on the one hand, and I don't spend too much time focusing on this in my research, but I do think it's a particularly interesting phenomenon or juxtaposition. On the one hand, we have this recognition that the kinds of systemic change that is necessary to achieve these, you know, carbon emissions reductions goals. And I know that, you know, it's important to also focus on ecological objectives and biodiversity loss, and you know. But I'm focusing on the government's ability to deliver on these net zero or carbon neutrality goals specifically. But it's interesting that this recognition that systemic change has to come from governments has come at a time after huge disinvestment in public sector capabilities and capacity over many years, including in environmental agencies around the world. And increasingly we're seeing these calls from the private sector for more support, for more capacity, for more financing coming from government as well. And it's, you know, it's interesting, as you just, I guess, alluded to, that this is coming at a time of disinvestment in the public sector.
Yeah, super. So, I mean, with that kind of context, like, what are the first steps that we can do? Are there specific policy recommendations when you are, you know, talking or analysing specific governments, like the first steps they can do to move towards rebuilding their skills and capacity?
Yeah, so I'm looking, my PhD research specifically is looking at two things. It's looking at how governments are kind of acting or agitating to develop this capabilities, and I'm primarily looking empirically at what they're doing. There's been a lot of research looking at or trying to propose, or not necessarily research. There's been a lot of academic literature and policy literature, you know, describing what governments should be doing, and actually very little literature looking at what governments are doing and then trying to work from there, you know, what is going right and what is going wrong, or what could be done better. So I'm focusing on the kind of empirical angle. So lots of governments now have adopted these net zero strategies. I'm focusing on the two that, you know, in these global indexes have been ranked as one and two in terms of their policy ambitions. So Denmark and Chile. The reason I'm focusing on these two case studies is because, you know, you can control for the absence of political ambition to achieve net zero if it's mandated in or enshrined in legislation in the way that it is in Denmark and Chile. Now, what seems to be working well, you know, no surprises in Denmark, is the fact that they have this incredible access to resources. I think that is a kind of a no-brainer. In Chile, the thing that came up all the time in interviews, even when I'd be talking or trying to ask about other things, was the fact that there was very limited public sector resources to develop the bureaucracies and bureaucratic capabilities for developing the kind of capacity and knowledge internally for governing the green transition. Now, this becomes even more important in somewhere like Chile versus Denmark, where there is a big sector that is quite, or a few different sectors that are quite resistant to green transition interventions or green transition policies. You know, notably the mining industry in Chile, which is very concentrated and very powerful politically. And so in that context, it becomes even more important that there is a government that has the ability to, you know, even do things as simple as get information from these firms and analyze this information to be able to evaluate whether it is actually following or delivering on the things that it has agreed on. There are other things that are important. So, you know, for just as an example, the kind of structure of the public sector bureaucracy and the relative authority of different ministries seems to be very important. So Denmark in recent years, and so a kind of related interesting thing about Denmark is it has this reputation for being a leader in, you know, a global leader in green transition governance, right? But actually a lot of the capabilities that it had developed were in managing the export of wind technologies, which is very different to governing or coordinating a domestic green transition. You know, some of these things are related. And it's only recently in the past 6 years or so that it began to consolidate its climate governance bureaucracy through the Climate, Energy and Utilities Ministry and then a few different agencies that are part of it. And again, Denmark has been able to do that very successfully, in large part simply because it has the resources that many countries don't have. And it, of course, also has a coalition of like a business coalition that is very supportive of government support for the green transition and government action on the green transition, because it has a huge wind energy sector. So there are a few different things, and there seem to be some things that are not helping. So I haven't been looking specifically at management consultancies really in my PhD project at all. But in Chile, for example, you know, in this context of limited resources, 2/3 of the financing for the Ministry for the Environment or for Environmental Protection was coming from external development banks and other development agencies. And one thing that became very clear was that a lot of the people who were contracted through these development banks and these agencies were coming in on a really short-term basis. So the knowledge and this kind of learning that we would see as being quite important, you know, I guess the everyday term might be institutional memory that we would think is quite important as a resource for being able to govern green transitions is simply not able to develop because people are in and out all the time. So yeah, hopefully next time we speak, I'll have some more conclusions or more, perhaps even some policy recommendations. But at the moment I've been, you know, in the weeds of the empirical data for my PhD.
Yeah. And how can we measure a state's capacity to implement, you know, ambitious public policy like decarbonization?
Yeah, great question. There's a huge debate within the state capacity literature, and I don't think it's been resolved. So state capacity suffers from what is known as the dependent variable problem in the social sciences, where, you know, for example, is a state's ability, is a government's ability to effectively coordinate, you know, emissions reductions? Can we use it as a proxy for state capacity, or is it able to do that because there is strong capacity in this area? It's for this reason that I'm actually more interested in looking at which different types of actors influence and shape the development of capacity in particular areas, rather than, you know, I guess the more normative policy propositions for what is the most effective way to deliver on a green transition. Because I think it is very difficult to measure, and there are lots of different reasons why you know, one country might more effectively deliver on the green transition vis-a-vis others that have actually quite little to do with the government's ability. So yeah, I think I'm more interested in, you know, what is shaping the different approaches and the different structures the governments are taking, rather than which ones are more effective.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. So a lot of your and your co-author Mariana Mazzucato's work is on how the state can shape and direct innovation to solving big problems. But in ecological economics, we tend to think that the size of the economy now overwhelms the Earth's capacity to absorb its wastes. So we see a big part of the solution as not just technological innovation, but also fundamentally reducing consumption. So what role can states play in that? Because in a sense, that's about behavior and cultural change and not just market shaping.
No, I completely agree. I mean, you know, I guess what you've alluded to as well as some of these is, you know, relates to some of the debates around growth and degrowth. And I think one thing that's become quite clear in my own research is that when we think about governments, you know, I situate governments and national bureaucracies also within the international political economy. So there are some parts of national bureaucracies that have kind of embedded within their ways of behaving and embedded within their actions, this kind of pursuit of GDP, which is, as you know, all of your listeners will know, this stupid reductive measure, like vis-a-vis or rather than or GDP or growth that doesn't take account of other considerations or policy goals that might be in place. But at the same time, there are parts of government that are not set up simply to deliver GDP, or that in fact do not have growth kind of embedded in the same way within their ways of working and their actions. So, you know, many environment ministries, this has been my experience researching in Denmark and Chile, there is contestation often that's happening between treasuries and ministries of finance and the ministries for the environment or ministries of climate. That because often, you know, climate or green transition initiatives in Denmark, for example, are costly. You know, they're not necessarily going to create new technologies. That the things that the Danish government are adopting, not all of them, not all of these policies are going to lead to the development of new technologies or sources of energy that the Danish government can export, or that are going to create energy efficiencies. And they're driven by the kind of contestations within the you know, climate bureaucracy itself. You know, similarly within the welfare state systems, that the welfare states are not embedded within. There is an argument, of course, that a functioning welfare state is, you know, useful for GDP, but that kind of logic is not embedded within the institutions of the welfare state. Normally, there are other considerations, right? So, I think, of course, there are. In a green transition, there are parts of the government where it becomes their interest and their way of operating that they are supporting, you know, technological innovation, and that can have these kind of growth or export-led growth elements. But other parts of the state that isn't necessarily or doesn't have to be there. That their kind of reason for being, and they have an important role to play as well, you know. But I think I definitely land on the side of, and you know, this isn't a purely ideological position. I definitely land on the side of there needing to be more systemic economic change within, you know, in industry, for example, rather than simply consumer behavior, simply because that's where the more action is going to be realized, or the greater effects on climate emissions are going to be, or on carbon emissions, sorry, are going to be realized.
Yeah, perfect. So the state's not a black box. It's fundamentally shaped by the society within which it exists and cultural narratives and these kind of things. So a part of the problem historically has been that it's susceptible to elite capture, which shapes economic policy. So what's the kind of role of bottom-up initiatives, you know, conceptualized outside the state in influencing the development of the state going forward for addressing, you know, major sustainability challenges?
Yeah, so great question. I look at both bottom up and inside out, and what I mean by that is that so, you know, historically, as we all know, very few, if any, kind of actually effective transformative climate policies have come simply from within the state itself. As you say, the state does not exist in a vacuum. It's not a black box. It is responsive to both public opinion, as well as the kind of interest group influence, but also to activism. And it has been historically, you know, radical change, whether in types of social policy or education or whatever, has usually come through organized activism or as part of a coalition putting pressure on the state for these things. And I think that's true, or certainly has historically been true, within climate policy as well. So it's important that, you know, organized groups maintain, and by which I don't just mean kind of activists on the street, as important as they are, but also organized groups of scientists have been a very important source of pressure environmental policy historically, and activist academics have been a very important pressure on governments. But one thing that I'm interested in as well, and again this is something that has become abundantly clear in my research, is the role that activist bureaucrats can play within government. And that probably sounds like a little bit of an oxymoron to some of your listeners. And of course we don't want bureaucrats, you know, to be going beyond what is mandated of them democratically, right? But we do know that when there is concerted resistance to climate policies and green transition policies that have been decided in response to, you know, a democratic mandate, sometimes, you know, politicians don't deliver on them for all sorts of reasons, and bureaucracies, civil servants don't deliver on them for all sorts of reasons. And actually, in these situations, the role of individuals within the public sector in continuing to push for policies and ensure that policies and institutionalizing structures that ensure that policies to support green transition agendas are realized are really important. And I think, bureaucracies are not, dominated by elites anymore. This is empirically not true. You know, in the 50s in the UK, it made sense, you know, that we just had a couple of, you know, relative to today, there are very few people working in the public sector. So it kind of made sense that they were, you know, of an elite class or whatever. But now in a situation or in countries where actually many people are working for the public sector, and many people in Chile, for example, have gone into work for the public sector and the climate ministries because they are passionate about these issues and they want the government to play an important role in their realization or in the realization of green transitions, actually there is a form of activism that can come from within governments as well.
That is wonderful. It really chimes with some of my own experience working with government agencies in the UK as well. So Rosie, I mean, I've learned so much from this conversation. I can't thank you enough. Finally, I'll ask the question we always finish with. So what is your rebellion?
Yeah, this is a good question. And one that I am really struggling to think of. I guess my rebellion is that I'm deeply cynical. I'm not deeply cynical. I'm pretty cynical about academia. I love academia. I love being a researcher. But I also recognize its limitations in ways that I often don't see other people within academia kind of recognizing. I mentioned earlier that there has been quite a lot of literature recently from academics trying to develop these pathways to green transitions and what should this look like and all of this. And I think that that's great, but I'm also not convinced that academics should be the ones coming up with these ideas. I think the role of academics is to try to demystify things and, potentially come up with some ideas for things to do better based on things that we find out are going wrong or are going well. I don't think the world should be run by, you know, philosopher kings or whatever. And academics often, I think, would disagree with that. So I guess that's my rebellion, that I maybe have a different view of the role of academics than many people in our field.
Thanks so much to Rosie Collington for joining us today, and thanks to all of you for spending time with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. If you like the conversation and your work is related to ecological economics in any discipline, consider becoming a member of our society to stay connected. If you are ready to discuss the topic, join our Facebook group called European Society for Ecological Economics.